Good afternoon, Chodesh Tov. Thank you so much to everyone for coming out. As noted before, it's nice to have spring finally here, and hopefully we'll get to enjoy the nice weather. So, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on I guess who you ask, we live in a rather litigious society. And oftentimes, if someone is unhappy, especially when it comes to money, there's a tendency to look for someone to blame, right? You can relate. So especially like someone like an accountant or financial advisor who's involved with making financial decisions is likely to bear the brunt of a client who suffered a loss. So it's of course true that losses are unavoidable. But Jewish and Canadian law do recognize that one who gives irresponsible advice may, under certain circumstances, be required to compensate the damaged party. Let's send the source sheet out again. Just make sure everyone has it. So, in our world, the dynamic with in a case of claiming damages in whatever areas, sometimes financial and you know, many times with damaged property, is insurance. And it's changed the dynamics of damage compensation. These damaged parties often possess insurance that will cover their losses. And errors and omissions insurance protects from malpractice claims and litigation, of course, within certain parameters. So before we explore, one, the liability that may be incurred from giving, say, negligent or irresponsible financial advice, I want to just throw out the question, just in general, when it comes to damages and insurance. So here's a question. We'll address it a little bit more in depth as we go on. So should one who damages be obligated to compensate the damaged party if that party will receive compensation from another source? So I'll give an extreme example, which is actually mentioned in the responsa literature of the last 200 years or so. So let's say Reuven sets a fire to Shimon's house, whether intentionally or he's negligent, and he's smoking and he throws in a cigarette butt. Whatever it may be, he sets a fire to Shimon's house. But Shimon has fire insurance. So does Reuven owe Shimon anything? What would you say?
Yes.
Yes. Why?
I think it's irrelevant that there's compensation for Shimon from another source. Reuven's caused the damage. He should pay.
Right. So I'll just push back. It definitely is a nezek tsar, ripui, different categories of damages. So that generally, it largely relates to damage to injuries. But let's say no one's injured. Let's say this is just property. So let's say Shimon was the one with the house. So let's say Shimon didn't have insurance and the damages were $100,000. So Reuven would be liable to $100,000. Instead, insurance is willing to cover it. Let's say it's no-fault insurance. So the insurance gives Shimon $100,000. Why should it be different? Meaning, what does it matter where the source comes from?
The person who got the insurance paid for the insurance.
He paid for the insurance, so it wasn't totally free.
His premiums may go up because of this claim.
So his premiums may go up. I say that could maybe be a side payment, but essentially the question comes to this, and we'll see this when we look at actual cases, is could we say, is damaging someone's property, if you damage someone's property, is there an inherent obligation to pay something, to pay the restitution from the damager? Or is it just to ensure that the damaged party is compensated?
Well, the arrangement is between the person supplying the service and the person receiving the service, i.e. that the person who's receiving the service happens to have insurance, has got nothing really to do with the person supplying the service. Supplying the service did a nezek, so it's his responsibility, and there's no relationship between the insurance and that person. If he had his own insurance, and his own insurance would cover him like negligence insurance, that's a different story. That's where he has an arrangement with the insurance company to compensate him for what he has to compensate the other person.
So if I understand correctly, it is saying that essentially the insurance is sort of a side deal that Shimon has, right?
That's correct.
He has something. He has, let's say, you could say it's another source of income or another arrangement, but that shouldn't exempt Shimon who owes him for the damage. Would anyone say otherwise?
But Jerry makes a very good point. I mean, if the damager had insurance to protect against his malpractice, then that insurance, or whether he pays or his insurance pays, shouldn't matter.
The money's still coming from Reuven.
Correct.
Right. But even let's say he gets a check for his insurance. So that I think is maybe akin to Reuven actually paying. Yes, Miriam.
Right, exactly.
Wouldn't the insurance first of all turn to the person who was damaged, who caused the damage, before I compensate you? If Shimon has recourse to getting Reuven to pay him for the damage that was caused, and let's say all of it, maybe the insurance doesn't have to pay anything. Maybe the first place to go is not to the insurance, but to the person who caused the damage. And
another factor, which when we get to the more contemporary cases, some of these questions, let's say in the 1800s, when we get to the contemporary cases, that's going to be a big factor. I mean, sometimes it's not so simple that the insurance will pay if there's been payment, or if there's a possibility of payment from another source. So that, of course, impacts the discussion on a practical level. Just to remind everyone who came in a little bit late, just to sign in so we get credit for the continuing education. So we'll take a look at that in a little bit. But now, fundamentally, and I know this has been discussed in previous years, what's the responsibility, what's the liability of someone who provides irresponsible advice? Meaning, is providing irresponsible advice considered to be damaging, or not necessarily? So I was copying the source sheet in the chat again, just so everyone can get it, and then we'll begin on there. So I'll just note, starting out, our discussion will touch upon some theoretical, some philosophical, and when it gets to the practical, both halachic and legal. So we'll obviously, will be questions, and each case has to be considered on its own. But I'll just note the importance of what we're doing, of studying the laws of damages. If you look at source number one, the Talmud in Bava Kamma tells you how, if someone wants to be a chassid, what should they do? So a chassid in the classic sense, not necessarily just to grow out the payas, which, may be helpful, but it says someone who wants to be a chassid says, l'kayem mili dinizikin. They should observe and learn about the order and the topics of nizikin, of damages. Because ultimately that's considered an essential part of our behavior between one another and our service to God. So it's very important. Sometimes we think of halakha as being in the ritual realm, but it's very much, very much in the financial realm, and it's part and parcel of our service of God. So now the question is, well, what's the liability? Let's say we don't have insurance. We're going to see if insurance mitigates it. But is someone who provides irresponsible advice or advice that causes a loss, is that considered a damage? So in this article, the Toronto Star, Ellen Roseman, in source number two, says in our society, again, I mentioned it's a litigious society. So someone, let's say, who invests, and now their savings have been shredded. and you're looking for someone to blame, right? We like doing that. So what about that financial advisor who pushed you into higher equity exposure because the higher risk products paid more commissions? Can you sue your advisor for negligence? Miriam says no.
I think there's a bit of caveat emptor here. You know, you're the buyer. You got to watch out in a case like that. You know that high risk investments may have the potential of a high reward, or you can lose everything. And that it should be stated by the advisor. But I think in a modern society, I think someone has to realize that you're rolling a dice a little bit and it's in your hands.
So you're saying that even though someone, a layperson, is working with advisor, they have some knowledge. You know, they're not expected to be totally in the dark. I mean, the advisor you're saying is someone who knows more, who assists, but the client is still responsible for having a basic level of knowledge.
I wonder to what extent the advisor has to disclose his commission scale.
Right. That's going to be interesting.
If you said he's making more by selling this or that.
Right. I mean, you're saying maybe there's a self-interest.
Correct.
That could be a consideration as well. So what about liability for bad advice? So if someone damages someone's property or injures someone, so there's financial liability. But what about giving someone advice that when the person listens to results in a damage?
Is it bad advice after the fact, or even from the outset one could have told it was bad advice? Because after the fact, bad advice might not have been bad advice from the outset, and it would be unfair to hold that person as responsible when they held a duty of care and they were rigorous at the time.
Right. So that's a major factor is, what are they expect? If you're going to claim that the advisor was irresponsible, so it would seem to be, and it seems pretty clear, both in Jewish law and Canadian law, that there has to be an element of negligence, or there has to be at least something that, whether intentional, you know, certainly, but also it would be an expectation that the person advising or the person accepting that or being trusted with that responsibility, the expectation that they should know something. And if it's something that they should have known, that may be negligence. But of course, they will, and we'll see what they are. But there are cases where, you know, we aren't prophets. We're told that we're descendants of prophets, but we're not the prophets. We can't predict the future. So if someone does everything that they're supposed to, so it would certainly seem to be unfair to hold them responsible, even though, you know, probably many people would like to.
If somebody acts and you're by bad advice, isn't it a mixture of neither?
Isn't Lifnei Iver? So if you look, actually, we're going to get to that right now. If you look at source number 3, so there's a prohibition in the Torah. The Lifnei Iver lo titen mixture, that you shouldn't place a stumbling block before a blind person. So actually the classic case that the Talmud understands this prohibition as applying to is enabling someone to sin. So that if someone is, let's say, a Nazir, and you enable them to have a cup of wine, or as a non-Jew, and you give them the Aver Minachai, meat from a limb torn from a live animal, so you are enabling them to sin. If they're blind, or so then you're enabling them to sin, and that's a classic violation of Lifnei Iver, putting a stumbling block before the blind. Interestingly enough, there's some discussion whether this also applies to the literal case of actually putting a stumbling block before a blind person. So many say that it in fact does. Some actually limit it to the cases of causing one to sin. But look at source number 4, Rashi, based on a Medrash, says, what does it mean before the blind? Maybe not someone who's literally blind, but someone who's blind regarding a certain matter. Maybe you could say, just if we're thinking about our case, if a financial advisor, an accountant, is dealing with someone, they're maybe coming to advice because they're not very knowledgeable about the best decisions. So it's just someone who's blind about a certain matter. So don't give them advice that's improper. And for example, don't say, sell your field and buy a donkey with the proceeds. Well, in truth, you plan to cheat him since you yourself will take it from him by lending him the money and taking the donkey as collateral. In that case, he won't be able to take the field because a previous creditor has a lien on it. So that's one example. So that may be malicious, but seemingly, even if it's not entirely malicious, you shouldn't take advantage of someone by giving them advice that's not going to benefit them or that's going to be harmful to them. But so we're told this is a prohibition in the Torah, but not every prohibition in the Torah is punished by either physical punishment or in our case, monetary punishment. There are certain things that the Torah prohibits, we're not allowed to do, but there's no formal punishment. For example, Lashon Hara is a very, very terrible thing. There's no concrete punishment for that. From heaven, there's punishment, but there are things that are wrong, that are prohibited, but don't necessarily carry a penalty. So what about giving advice? Giving advice that will be damaging. So one of the things that we have to consider is the level of connection between the advice and the damage. And one of the mitigating factors, maybe a concept called grumma. Grumma is something basically causation. It's not something that's direct. You do something and then somehow that action will trigger or lead to something else which triggers a damage. So it applies in some areas of Shabbos where you didn't do something, but then that'll trigger forbidden labor. In our case, it applies in the case of damages. It applies to doing an action which then we'll see there's a disconnect between that action and the damage. So one case is the following in Bava Kamma, number 5. It says you threw something off of a roof and there were cushions or blankets below. So if you land on them, they wouldn't break. Another person came and removed the cushions before they landed. So is the person who threw it off liable? I don't know why you're doing that, but whatever, you're throwing stuff off the roof. And you see there's a big parade, there's a one of those blow-up castles where the kids jump out of. So you throw something on the ground, you think it's not going to break. Someone goes before it lands on the ground, someone moves the cushions out of the way, and now the utensils break. So is the person who threw them responsible? So Gemara says that he's exempt. Because at the time that he threw it, it said literally his arrows were stopped, but there was no, the act wasn't an act that would in and of itself cause damage. Another thing happened in between, which then resulted in the items being damaged, but the act that that the person who threw these utensils off of a roof wasn't an inherently damaging act. And there's a principle when it comes to grumma the nisikin, that grumma, something, a causation, when it comes to damages, is exempt. They're liable from heaven. Just like we said, other things are not good. And there's, we generally want to avoid being liable from heaven. But nevertheless, there's not going to be a monetary payment that's required. So just note, other examples of grumma could be when you unlock someone's gate. Someone has a pen, you unlock their gate, and then an animal escapes or someone else comes in. So you could say the understanding is, it certainly was an irresponsible thing to do, but you didn't actually damage what became damaged as a result of opening the gate. So you're held liable by heaven, but you're not going to be required to pay a financial penalty or to compensate the victim of the damage.
What if there was a sign on the gate saying that if you leave the gate open, you'll be responsible for any loss of livestock that leaves? Does that change anything?
Right. So like, you didn't, right, you didn't actually do the damage, but...
Well, by leaving the gate open, you were made very aware that leaving the gate open, you know, the livestock is very close to the gate, and chances are, when you do this, something, like, you're not clued out. You now know that you're going to likely cause the damage because it's been brought to your attention very clearly. Would that change anything?
So we'll see in a minute is there's a category similar to Grumma called Garmi, which is, there's a question about what exactly the difference is, but it's more direct. It could be if there's more of a knowledge or more of a either frequency that something like that will cause damage, maybe that would, or it's more foreseeable that damage will occur, that may, you're right, that something like that may be a mitigating factor. I don't want to say definitively, but that could be. Actually, just to go to cases where that would come up, would be, for example, with a more direct type of damage is, let's say you burn a loan document or something like that. So you do something that more, you know, directly causes damage, even though it's indirect. But leaving a sign, if that would mitigate it, I'm not sure, but it's an interesting point. I wonder if that would fall under the category of Garmi, because maybe there's more of a recognition that a common occurrence that the damage would be a common occurrence. It may depend where it is. If you live in the middle of nowhere, maybe don't expect a thief to come, as opposed to you live in the middle of a dangerous area. So I'm not sure, but it's an interesting point. There's one question in the chat. So how would that be enforced? You mean for indirect type of damage? Was that the... I mean, if you want to understand the question, is if something is... How would the sign in the gate be enforced? Right, so that's why it still could be indirect, meaning... I think that could be part of it. It's indirect. You can't necessarily draw a strong link between the action and the damage. Could be the action wouldn't cause the damage. So that's why it's difficult to actually extract payment, even though we say, and this is in source number 7, the Ramah on the Shulchan Aruch, Code of Jewish Law, says they are liable by heaven. Meaning it's not that they were saying it's a wonderful thing to do.
But in the absence of him opening the gate, the sheep would not have left the pen. How can we say that he didn't cause the sheep to leave the pen? Sure, he didn't pull the sheep out of the pen, but had he not opened the pen, the sheep would still be in the pen.
Okay, but just to push back, you could say, you know, in the dove or so, that you could say, you know, there could be no end to it. Meaning, you could open the pen, maybe the sheep would have stayed put. Maybe something else would have happened. Meaning, Nick, I you're certainly correct that it made it more vulnerable. But I think we are the person who does that is exempt from payment because we don't say that act itself caused directly. Cause damage, or maybe to say a little bit differently, that wasn't a damaging act per se. Maybe it was a contributor, but not necessarily a damaging act.
I guess it was a contributor, but not direct causation.
Right, and it's also possible that nothing would happen. Meaning, you damage something, I break something, so then it breaks. I do something that's, you know, that puts makes something more vulnerable. So it could be that they wouldn't have escaped. It could be that we can't necessarily say that it caused it, but we still say that there's a link as far as the person being responsible by heaven, which we want to avoid. So we skip ahead a little bit to look at source number 8. So source number 8 mentions a concept that we mentioned of, I'm going to call it like a super grumma, but I'm saying grumma is causative, so, or maybe less as far as the causation, but something that's, there's a greater link, and the commentaries in the Talmud, the legal authorities struggle to see the difference, because we'll see we rule according to the opinion that garmi, sort of the more direct, indirect action, the person doing it would be liable, and there's we'll take a look at some of the perspective, but you know, even when saying it out loud, it's hard to distinguish. I mean, there's an indirect action and there is an indirect action that's a little more direct where you are held responsible. So we'll see why exactly that is. So take a look at source number 8. So this will show us a case of garmi, of a more direct type of, we'll say, indirect causing of damage. So the case in the Gemara is as follows. So someone who shows a coin to a money changer, who they were tasked with seeing whether a coin was valid. You know, now our money is paper; it doesn't have, you know, intrinsic value, but it used to be that currency was actually worth something. So you would take the currency to a money changer to see if it was valid, to see if it would be accepted. So if you take it to this money changer, and let's say the money changer says that, oh yeah, this coin is great, you know, you can spend it anywhere, it's valuable, and then it turns out you then go to the, you know, the 7-Eleven, they have 7, yeah, they have 7-7, you go to the 7-Eleven and try to buy something, and they say, what is this? You know, this is well, I'm not accepting this. So is this money changer liable? Maybe otherwise you would have exchanged it for a different coin. But you, the money changer told you that this is a good coin, so you took it. So is the money changer liable for, you know, reimbursing you based on their incorrect advice? So the Gemara says, and it's source number 8, that it seems to be a dispute. So one indicates that they would be exempt, or that an expert would be exempt, meaning someone who this is, you know, they have a certificate that they completed the, you know, the money changing preparation course, but a non-expert would be liable. Meaning if I don't have the training, then I would be liable. If I had the training, I would be exempt. Another says that any money changer would be liable.
Isn't that counterintuitive? The one with the expertise is not liable if he makes a mistake?
I think it's very counterintuitive. So we'll see what that's referring to. But it definitely seems counterintuitive that an expert makes a mistake, he's exempt. The non-expert makes a mistake, he's liable. So what exactly are we speaking about? So Rav Papa said that when it says that the view that exempts an expert refers to someone like these people named Danko and Isor, these two money changers, Danko and Isor LLP, and it said they lack no knowledge and erred only with regard to a newly minted coin, meaning they were more equivalent to what was mentioned before, that you can't, there's only so much knowledge you can have. And if someone, to the best of their ability, you know, gives the knowledge, and then the result turns out to be undesirable, you can't hold them responsible. This would be, it says, a newly minted coin. This day was more difficult to determine what the value was. So if they give an opinion on that, and you know, their opinion was just that based on everything that they knew, and there wasn't more to know. It said that they lacked no knowledge. Right, they didn't need any more training. They were as an expert as it came. So if they made a mistake, so then they would be exempt. But what about so the next case is a woman shows a coin to Rabbi Chiya, who was an expert but wasn't paid, and he approved it. The next day, she told him, "While I went, I showed it to others who rejected it, and I couldn't spend it." So Rabbi Chiya said, "Exchange it for her. You know, it's on me. I'll provide you with a replacement, and then put this on the record that this was a bad deal." But why should that be? The Gemara asked, "Well, Rabbi Chiya was an expert like Danko and Isor." So it says, really, in that case, so the case was he wasn't taking any payment for it, and he was an expert. So it says, really, he should have been exempt. But it says he went lichnim mishura sadin. He went above the letter of the law. Then you have another case where Lakish showed a coin to Rabbi Elazar, who is not an expert, who approved it. But there's a little bit difference in this case. Rish Lakish says, he says, "I depend on you. This is what you're telling me. Just to know, I'm depending on you. So Rabbi Lezer says, what does that mean? If you wish to be able to exchange it in the event that it's found to be bad, wouldn't this be, now we get to the case of garmi, this more direct, indirect type of damage. So wouldn't be a case of garmi, according to the view of Rabbi Meir. That I didn't cause you, I didn't actually damage you, I didn't, you know, take your money, or damage your belongings, but I gave you advice that then, saying more directly, meaning there was more of a link between my advice and your acceptance of the coin and using it to spend. So we say that we actually go like the opinion, not that grama, the more indirect, but garmi, so the more direct indirect action is actually can be collected. So basically what this is saying is to sum it up, is someone who is negligently gives bad advice is liable, but if he's fully trained, then he wouldn't be liable. Meaning if there's nothing more to know, if someone who's not an expert gives advice that's damaging. So if the person says that he relies on him, then even a non-expert, even a layman, would be held responsible.
But is it the fact that he has a certificate that he's an expert, or the fact that he spent 5 hours looking at the coin and doing everything right in examining it that exempts him? Because having a certificate and really being an expert, but if you just breezed through it and didn't do the right things, shouldn't you be the most liable? Someone is coming, paying you for advice. They're looking at your certificate and you said, come back in an hour, but you didn't spend any time. You gave them advice. What kind of society would let someone get away with that? That doesn't feel like, okay, it's fine for him now. He gets away with it. But how does society function if you don't, make people responsible when they've got, an accreditation that they're supposed to be good.
Right. So that may be the case like Rebbe Lezer, meaning someone who's not an expert. So that may be to the factor may be in certain cases, and this we'll see, is actually almost identical in Canadian law. It's fascinating. But that may be the extent to which a person relies on it. And it could be relies on it through saying that they rely on it or that they offer payment. For example, if I have a friend who I know collects coins or knows, or I'll actually give you an example. I have a friend who decided he was, getting into investing a little bit. He's not trained. Basically, he has the app on his phone. He decides he wants to buy this. So he's saying, you should do this. But it wasn't, I wasn't sitting down with him in a formal meeting. So let's say he says, you should invest in, an Apple. And okay, that's nice. But the context of the conversation, I was going to say, either I didn't say, oh, you're really telling me this, I'm relying on you and now I'm going to make this decision. Or, why don't we sit down? You're giving me valuable advice. Let me pay you. I didn't do something that demonstrates that I was really relying on it. So you could say, okay, it was a casual conversation. So as far as the attention paid to the to the coin, looking at it quickly, so that may depend on the context. If it's just showing to your friend, he takes a look at it, and I think this is good, that's different than actually showing reliance on it. So just the distinction now between this grama and garmi. So again, there are different perspectives. Rabbeinu Asher, the Rush, it's verse number 9, it says, what's the difference? Is that when you personally cause damage to property, in a way that the loss will certainly come about, so that's considered garmi. For example, someone who burns a loan document or forgives a loan that was sold to someone else is liable for the damage. And Reno Asher brings our case. Someone who shows a dinar to a money changer who assesses that the coin is valid and it's not, is a form of damage. Even though at that moment, the money changer isn't causing damage, but it's certainly going to result in a loss, that would be, in that case, that would be considered garmi, the more direct type of indirect, and then the party that caused the lawsuit would be culpable. Just go down to
ask a question. Going back to the the case of the gate, if it was one of those gates that had some sort of magnetized thing so that it would always close as soon as it was open, and someone, because they were going in and out, removed that magnet thing, and it was during that time when they removed the magnet that the door didn't close properly, and damage occurred, either somebody, you know, let's say the livestock left or whatever, would that be different? Because you've disabled something that had a certain function of safety.
Right, that may be property damage in of itself, but as far as the link
between... Well, I mean, it was just like moving disabling it by turning something off. You didn't damage it. It could be restored. Right.
But so I'm not positive, but just mention that is one of the classic cases of grumma, meaning of the more indirect. I'm not sure, but definitely something to look into. There is this distinction between grumma and garmi. So one is that it's something that's bound to cause damage, even though that action doesn't directly cause the damage. And there are other perspectives as well in source number 11. So it could be that maybe there's no intrinsic difference between this grumma and garmi, but rather in cases that are common, so really for punitive purposes, the sages instituted a fine. And really the difference is the frequency and lack of frequency. So according to this approach, the sages instituted a fine for indirectly causing damages in common cases. So he says in source number 11, so should the aforementioned types of negligent misrepresentation be commonplace today in the brokerage industry, there may be grounds for mandating liability based upon the actions being deemed garmi. And maybe it's certainly you determine which are more common. And in those things, you want to prevent, you know, the breakdown of society. So then you, in those cases, do require payment. And so perhaps this would, so perhaps just from the frequency, there may be grounds for requiring payment in, irresponsible financial advising. So basically the breakdown is, and this is in source number 12, but the break, just so we can get to the insurance part. So the breakdown is basically, if they're an expert and they're paid, then they're liable. If they're an expert, unless they're the super expert, if they're an expert and unpaid, so then they're not liable. If they're a lay person and paid, so then they're liable. Again, this demonstration that you're relying on them. And if they're a lay person and unpaid, they're not liable unless there was a verbal acknowledgement that the advice was being relied upon.
What if they give written advice? Does that change anything?
Why would that be more official?
Don't you think putting something on letterhead and signing it with your professional name makes it quite official compared to just speaking off the cuff?
Right, but as far as the party being damaged, meaning it sounds like it's more of an acknowledgement or this recognition of the party who has been damaged, that I was really, you know, I'm really relying on you.
Absolutely.
But there's an using with writing letters an additional element of taking responsibility.
Right.
And that could be. The question is, so now we'll get to how this plays into Canadian law. So it's fascinating that it's so similar. If you look at source number 14, we're skipping a little bit, but some of these ideas we've set outside. So the extent of reliance is a major factor. So one, if there is an establishment of the fiduciary relationship or a general reliance, so then there needs to be a stronger level of consideration. There's a stronger culpability for giving, let's say, irresponsible advice. So either something that's misrepresentation, or something that was common knowledge that the advisor, the accountant, you know, failed to consider, failed to act based upon. So if there's a recognition of reliance, so then there's going to be a greater level of responsibility. And if you look at source number 15, so it says that there are five general requirements for a successful claim. So there must be a duty of care based on a special relationship between the representor and the representee. The representation in question must be untrue, inaccurate, or misleading. The representor must have acted negligently in making the misrepresentation. And four, the representee must have relied in a reasonable manner on the negligent misrepresentation. And the rule five, the reliance must have been detrimental to the representee in the sense that damages resulted. So again, there's this emphasis on reliance, and certain types of relationship maybe automatically create a reliance, but that's the main factor. And it makes a lot of sense because, then nobody could talk to each other. Some people talk or just around in the coffee room or whatever, just is saying different, and well, I think this is a good idea, not a good idea. But if there's a demonstration of reliance, then there will be responsibility. And if you just look back at source number 14, the CPA Code of Professional Conduct from CPA Ontario, it says that even if they're not paid, if they're a volunteer, if there's this acknowledgement of reliance, then they may be responsible. Okay, so now the question is, so can you sue, right? That's how we started. So can you sue your advisor for negligence? So number 16, continuing the article that we saw in the beginning. So it depends. And it depends, as was mentioned before, how much autonomy you gave to the advisor. So it says, for example, if you gave directions to your advisor to make all the buying and selling decisions in your accounts without consulting you, so this is called a discretionary relationship. In such a case, the court may decide that the advisor had a duty of care to you because of your dependency and vulnerability. It says, but as we mentioned, most clients don't hand over authority to advisors. They're involved to some degree, even if it's just to say yes, every time they're called with a trading request. But is that basically accurate? They're usually not entirely. I'll give you, take care of it for me. And she mentions, I didn't put this as part of the article, but there have been cases like that. And that's one of the factors that needs to be determined, that some of the advisor could respond that, well, I assumed that was more than just an order taker. So that could be a mitigating factor. And Moshe Feinstein actually says very similarly, source number 17, that basically if you hand over all responsibility, so then that will give greater liability to the advisor. So now, what about insurance? So we said, just to sum up, we said that there obviously is not always liability. And if someone is an expert and is doing everything that based on the information that's available, so then they're not going to be held responsible. But if there's a reliance and there's something that's irresponsible, so then there could be liability in both in Jewish law and in Canadian law. So what about insurance? Let's say we'll just again consider just damages in general. If we view this as this discussion as a type of damage, so then does insurance absolve liability? So I remember at the beginning, if we were to take a vote, I think most people seem to say that it shouldn't absolve the damager of liability. Right? That's anyone vote otherwise? Okay, so actually, there'll be some who disagree. So if you look at source number 18, Ramir Simchov Dvinsk, he was the late 1800s, early 1900s. So he talks about the following case. Someone rents a house and the renter, the tenant, accepted liability upon himself in the event of a fire. Okay, maybe that was part of the original contract. Then the landlord maybe wasn't so sure. He wanted to protect himself even more. So he purchased fire insurance. So the house unfortunately burnt down. So now does the tenant have to pay for the damage? Because that was part of the original agreement. So it sounded like most people, at least initially, said yes. Now I get a message that said no. So Meir Simcha Vince, who is the Arsameach, so he says that the tenant still has to pay, still has to compensate. Why? He brings a proof from the following case. It just shows the Talmudic mind to be able to extrapolate this. So the case was, you can see it in number 19 is the Mishnah, but just for the sake of time, we'll go to number 20, which is the Gemara. So you have two people. The basic law is, you have a situation, let's say someone has a more expensive donkey and a less expensive donkey, and they're being washed away by water. It looks like they both may be washed away, certainly if they're left unguarded. The owner of the expensive donkey, let's say the $200 donkey, maybe more than that, but those are the numbers that it gives, says, you know what, I'll pay you for, I don't want to lose my donkey. You're strong, you know how to swim, go in and get it, and I'll give you the 100 for your donkey. So the guy with the $100 donkey goes in, rescues it, and lo and behold, he didn't actually lose his donkey. Hmm. So does the guy still have to pay him? The one who originally said that they would pay if he went in to rescue the donkey. So as the Gemara say, they ask the question to Rav, and the Gemara says, why shouldn't he? Mishmaya Rakmula, that heaven was merciful upon him. It was very good, very lucky. They still made a deal that for jumping in, he gets paid. So, and there could be different reasons. It could be that then he abandoned, the one with the cheaper donkey abandoned ownership of it. But the Gemara seems to be, if you make a deal, you accept an obligation, even if the conditions that develop make, let's say, that the original intent unnecessary, but you accepted the obligation. So he draws the analogy, he says, based on this, source number 21, he says, so because the owner of the rescued donkey isn't able to say, I didn't accept responsibility for your donkey with the scenario in mind in which your donkey wasn't harmed, because the rescuer can respond, what concern is it to you of heaven and mercy on me? Meaning that's none of your business. You accepted the responsibility, and okay, I had enough, that's my business. So, and he says, maybe this is even more in our case, because the fact that the owner paid premiums to his insurance company in return for assuming the risk on the house can't exempt the tenant from the responsibility he accepted. In other words, it was like a side business deal. He had to deal with, you know, some, let's say it's the insurance company that they would pay in this situation. Why should that affect whether the tenant has to pay if he made that agreement? And so just to line up who's who. So basically it's that the homeowner is like the owner of the cheaper donkey who, and then the tenant is like the owner of the more expensive donkey. And it said, just because the homeowner, like the owner of the cheaper donkey, didn't actually lose money, the tenant, like the owner of the expensive donkey, is bound by the agreement. So he extrapolates from there that that the tenant would still be responsible. So now if we just go to 23. We'll see 23 before 22. So in number 23, it quotes another similar opinion. That, so now this is the case of the arson. This is the extreme case. So regarding a case of arson, so regarding the case of arson, so someone burnt down the house, and so if there was already an acceptance to an agreement to pay, so the Marsham, the 19th century, says that he still has an obligation to pay. Why? So here are some of the main points. Because even though the property owner's loss was covered by insurance, but at the time he burnt the house, so the arson was liable for, he's liable for compensation. And if the householder profited in accepting insurance, says what import is there to the arsonist in this? Meaning that's his own, You know, it's like someone, let's say, you know, parents sometimes will provide, you know, assistance in the case that a, you know, child needs. So, okay, they're getting, it's as if he's getting money from somewhere else. That's none of the arsonist business. He said also, and this is similar to, I think, what some expressed, since arson is a crime, and moreover, since failure to, in this according to that law, since failure to inform the authorities of the identity of the arsonist is itself a culpable offense, it's clear that the insurance company didn't intend its payment to be construed as being proffered on behalf of the arsonist. And also, the wrongful act did indeed cause financial loss in its commission. Subsequent compensation by a third party doesn't nullify an already existing obligation. He also says that just logic dictates there's nothing to prevent the insured from retaining the right to proceed against the person who sets the fire. And also that finally, as we mentioned, insurance policy can be characterized as a commercial enterprise. And therefore, that's the owner's business and not going to exempt the arsonist. However, others disagree. If you go back to number 22, this is also written around the same time. So he disagrees. Hare B'Samim or Aryalei Bar-Horovitz in the 19th century. So he says that, so upon securing payment from his insurance company, the homeowner seeks identical damages from the one responsible. So he rules in that case. This is on page 5, on the top of page 5. So the homeowner, he says, is not entitled to further compensation. Since according to the terms of the insurance policy, and this is going to be relevant nowadays, and I think it's the case with insurance policy. So according to the terms of the insurance policy, the homeowner is compensated for fire damage, and the person who set the fire has caused the homeowner no actual loss, right? Because he gets the loss from the insurance company. So hence, it's between the homeowner and the damager, the homeowner has no claim because the loss was recovered. However, if his premiums go up, so then Reuven, who set the fire, would have to compensate. But he had insurance, so he's saying he didn't actually cause a loss because the terms of the insurance were that apparently in such a case, they would pay for it. So it was sort of an automatic security built in.
Just a quick question. What if in a society, most people have insurance on their house? Like it's almost 100% of the time you have insurance on your house, and this person happens not to have insurance for whatever reason. And the damager, who isn't a tenant and innocent, but the damager says, you have insurance, so I'm not going to give you any money. And the person says, actually, I didn't have insurance. And the damager says, but it's so common for people to have insurance. It's not right. You've hurt me by not having insurance.
We'll see that particularly with car insurance, that's going to be addressed. You look at source 24. So that's a similar thing is addressed. We're just a little bit short on time. So Rav Yitzchak Yaakov Weiss in the 20th century. So the case that he's speaking about is, someone who gets into a car accident or someone who borrows a car and damages it. So he borrows your friend's car and unfortunately you get into an accident. So in that case, his insurance will cover it, right? Well, different insurance companies have different policies, but in such a case, his insurance company will cover even when the friend who borrowed the car damaged it. So can the owner of the car demand compensation from his friend? Because they're not such good friends anymore. So he says on the top of page 6, so he said it's the custom of the land not to demand. In other words, just to put in other terms, can he double dip? He's going to get paid by the insurance company. So this is actually a similar question to what we were saying before. And most people here said that they could still collect from the damager. Now, what do you think? Think you can double dip? That's essentially what it is. Who's for double dipping?
No, I think the insurance company shouldn't have to pay if you can collect it from the person who caused the damage.
Let's say an insurance company is paying. Meaning that's. Let's even say they're not going to. The premiums aren't going to go up. You bought whatever level of insurance, and they will pay in such a case. You're saying more it's just a punitive thing. Forget about the insurance company. Make the friend pay. It's tricky. So he says no. He says you can't double dip for a couple of reasons. One, it's the custom of the land not to demand compensation from the borrower when insurance compensation is forthcoming, right? We're thinking more, you know, ideologically, in principle, he should pay, but in reality, okay, you're getting a check from the insurance company. You're probably not going to go after, you know, the poor kid who smashed up your car. Since the borrower may plead that it was an implied condition of the contract, the bailment contract, when you rented the car, they would not be liable under such, or when you borrowed the car, they would not be liable under such circumstances. Meaning maybe I don't expect to pay, you know, for your car because you have insurance. And it says common knowledge that every automobile owner has insurance coverage, and indeed such coverage is mandated by law. And it says it wouldn't occur, this is when you get into the double dipping, it wouldn't even occur to any moral person to demand payment from the borrower as well, since he receives payment from the insurance company, and it's also against the law. He says, however, if there are premiums, the owner of the car can demand the payment of the premiums. And from my understanding, this is probably the way things work with more modern insurance. In general, insurance is going to pay if another party isn't paying. If another party is paying, so generally I think the insurance won't, you know, the terms won't allow you to double dip. So he says, Yaakov Yitzchak Weiss, Yitzchak Yaakov Weiss says that he can't double dip. If he's getting money from the insurance, then the owner of the car can also demand payment for that. So we'd have to see what kind of insurance a client would have. Maybe there aren't so many types of insurance that they would have to protect them from a bad investment. But probably more common is, what about professional liability insurance or errors and omissions insurance that, let's say, the advisor has, the accountant has. So is that, when we get to our question, does insurance allow for, does it cover risky advice? I think fundamentally that would depend on what your insurance covers, what this liability insurance covers. So it says in the source number 25. So basically, you have to see this policy will specifically lay out what and who is covered. And this is, the policy will likely cover a breach of fiduciary duty, lack of regulatory compliance, and legal coverage. But some things are excluded. Maybe discretionary advice is excluded. So you have to see what the contract, what the contract of the insurance actually covers. So as far as the question, does it cover risky advice? It would seem that if the accountant or advisor has E&O insurance, that will cover a case. Maybe, I'm not positive, but maybe that would at least give a certain comfort with giving, you know, let's say risky advice, but that could be to the benefit if either way the affected party will receive payment. At the same time, shouldn't exclude, you know, behavior that's illegal. So I'll just conclude with a statement from Pirkei Avos. Just about, we talk about some of the technicalities, and you know, technicalities are complex, and you know, every situation that we encounter has to be evaluated within Jewish law and civil law. But as far as the values that I think we should pick up from this is what Rabbi Yossi says in Pirkei Avos. Rabbi Yossi says, source number 26, "Hi mamon chavercha chaviv lecha ishelach," that let the property of your fellow be as precious to you as your own. That when advising people on how to spend money, what to do with their belongings, so we should treat it, we should view it as if it's our property, that we should be interested in their success, do everything we can to avoid harm. And hopefully with this mindset, our professions of advising and accounting should be one of helping our fellow Jews and certainly avoiding to cause them any loss. It is a